It's not. Don't pretend like you've never heard of that before, okay? Lucifer just said, he's not taking care of me. I'm going to spend my time, my effort, my brain power taking care of number one. That's me. He's not doing it. I'm going to have to. It would be fascinating to know exactly what the details were, but we don't have to know the details. We can know that much very easily. Lucifer somehow convinced himself that not only was it a good idea for him to take care of himself, but he must have convinced himself somehow that he could actually do a better job of taking care of himself than God could, or at least than God was. And hey, really, you know, if it was okay for God to take care of himself, surely it would be okay for Lucifer to take care of himself. If it's good for God, it's got to be good for me. How can I go wrong doing what God does? So take your Bibles now, if you'd be so kind, and turn to Isaiah chapter 14. I usually put all this sort of stuff up on the screen, but we're going to do an old media presentation today. So take your Bibles, turn to Isaiah chapter 14. We're going to notice a few verses. We'll start at Isaiah 14, verse 13. I'm just going to kind of pick some phrases here. Lucifer said, I will ascend into heaven. I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. Now, he's not saying he's going to exalt himself above God. He's just above the stars. Verse 14. Lucifer decided that he wanted to be like the Most High. Take real good note of that. He said, I'm going to be like God. This is what God is like. God exalts his throne. And I'm going to be like him. Out of all of this thinking from Lucifer came something that the Bible calls the lie. Turn to 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. The lie. Now, if you have a King James Bible, an old King James Bible, or an original King James Bible, or whatever you want to call it, in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 11, right at the end of the sentence there, you will see that it says that they should believe a lie. But if you have a New King James Bible, which is what the ones in the pew are, you'll see that it says that they should believe the lie. Not just any old lie, a very specific lie. Those who are supposed to be qualified in such matters of Greek translation and such tell me that the lie is the better translation. This is not just, I don't know, something about the article. You know, it's a specific article. I don't know how they do that in Greek. But anyhow. This is the lie. This is the underlying lie of all lies. The lie that says God exalts himself. That's the lie. God does not exalt himself. Lucifer said he did. Of course, there was no good reason for any of all this. We may never know and understand exactly what Lucifer believed. We don't even know for sure whether he believed his own nonsense. I don't, anyhow. Maybe you do. Congratulations if you do. I don't. But what is safe to say is that there was never any good reason for Lucifer to believe any of this stuff. God had never yet, period, to date, never has yet done anything that was not in the best interest of all his subjects. Now, I can say that, and I believe that, and the Bible says that, and hopefully you believe that, and that hasn't been proven yet. That's what the Great Controversy is all about, is proving that. Because the Great Controversy is over the lie. Lucifer said, God is exalting himself at our expense. And if it's good for him, I don't know why it can't be good for me. That hasn't been proven yet. A big chunk of information, a big chunk of evidence was delivered, what, 1,919 years ago or something, whatever the figures work out to be, right? At the cross. God demonstrated to a great degree and closed off most, but not all, of the loopholes of Lucifer's lie. But it's not fully demonstrated, and we're not going to go into full discussion of that today because we don't have time. But anyhow, so I'm going to say that there was never any good reason. The Bible implies as much. Why Lucifer thought what he did will always be a mystery, since there was no reason for it. If you're still in 2 Thessalonians, turn to chapter 2, verse 7. The Bible calls this the mystery of iniquity in the King James, and the mystery of lawlessness in the New King James. I have to admit, I like mystery of iniquity better. It has a nicer ring to it. But mystery of lawlessness is actually a more specific translation, so I'm going to have to go with that for the technical reasons. It has to do with the breaking of the law. What law? What law? What law did Lucifer break? Well, just like we don't know all the details of some of the other things, we maybe don't know all the details of that one. But the nice thing is that it doesn't matter. Turn to Matthew chapter 22. It really doesn't much matter what detail of law Lucifer might have violated. Matthew 22:37 and onward, Jesus said to his questioner, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind. This is the first and great commandment, and the second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets." So what did Lucifer break? He broke the law that said you love other people first. He said, "I will take care of myself." The law says that's not your job. Stop it. It's not your job to take care of yourself. Your job is to love other people. Since all the law hangs on these two commandments, we can also say that all sin hangs on the violation of these two commandments. But back to a point made before. Notice this. It was impossible for Lucifer to get upset about God shortchanging him without first losing his confidence that God was taking care of him. The whole idea that God was exalting himself, did Lucifer believe that? I don't know. It may have just been a good excuse so that it made sense to say, well, he's not taking care of me, he's too busy taking care of himself. It also made a good excuse for Lucifer doing what he wanted to do, which was to exalt himself. God's doing it, so I can too. The important thing to understand is that all of this comes from losing trust that God is taking care of me. That's a huge issue. That issue, that idea right there, is so big that Ellen White repeatedly, in different terminology, refers to this as the law of life. You want to live? Here's the law. You want to die? Break it. Some quick examples. Desire of Ages, page 19. The self-renouncing love is the law of life. Desire of Ages 21. She speaks of the circuit of beneficence with everybody being nice to the other guy. It's kind of like you get 20 people and they all start doing back rubs, right? You've seen that, okay? They're all going around and around the circle. It's so much easier than trying to rub your own back. The circuit of beneficence. Education, page 103, says the great law of life is a law of service. Desire of Ages, 623, to give is to live. Education, 110, self-sacrifice is the law of self-preservation. Signs of the Times, July 1, 1897. Self-renunciation is the great law of self-preservation. And self-preservation is the law of self-destruction. Probably the one I like the best, just because it's simple. Education, page 103, says that all things except for human beings and fallen angels, everybody that's doing what God wants them to do in the universe, they follow a simple principle. She says it means they take to give. They take to give. The context she's using, talking about that, is in the Lessons of Nature, illustrating this. She talks about plants that take in carbon dioxide and they give off oxygen, right? People and animals take in oxygen and give off carbon dioxide. It's good, kind of works that way. If either one of them died off, the other one would too, okay? The ocean takes water from streams and rivers, but it's the source of all the moisture that goes up, evaporation, right? The whole hydrologic cycle, if you remember your seventh grade math class or science class, okay? Everything in nature takes to give. So we need to understand the idea of taking to give. This is not just a good idea. It's not something that's really important. This is the law of life. Without understanding take to give, we are dead. So, is this biblical? Well, yes. Turn to the book of Hebrews. Chapter 6, Paul talks about this. In fact, it was probably from Paul that Ellen White got some of her illustrations. Hebrews chapter 6, verses 7 and 8. For the earth, which drinks in the rain that often comes upon it and bears herbs useful for those by whom it is cultivated, receives blessing from God. But if it bears thorns and briars, it is rejected and near to being cursed, whose end is to be burned. You take the good things, you give the good things. You take the good things and you give bad things, because you're going to get burned. So where does this all start? Where does this taking to give process start? Well, it starts at birth. Okay? The Bible tells us that God gives each of us a measure of faith. We need that much. That's what gets us going. That's what gets us started. It's the measure of faith where we can say, you know, I'm going to trust God. I'm going to trust Him. I think He's going to take care of me. God also gives us gifts. Turn to Romans chapter 12, if you'd be so kind. Romans 12, verse 3 and onwards. Paul, of course, writing, he says, "For I say through the grace given to me that to everyone who is among you, not to think of himself more highly than he ought to think, but to think soberly, as God has dealt to each one a measure of faith. For as we have many members in one body, but all the members do not have the same function, so we, being many, are one body in Christ, and individually members of one another. Having then gifts, differing according to the grace that is given to us, let us use them." Let us use them. I like that. It makes sense. God gave us faith, God gave us gifts, so why don't we use them? I bet that's why He gave them to us. Eh, Paul might not have said it with that same tone of voice, but that's the way I read it. In other words, we start off taking from God faith and at least one gift, you know, one talent, right? Something, whatever it is. When we take that from God, we're not stealing, because it's a gift. He gives it to us. But we still have the act of receiving on our part. Okay? Paul makes it clear that anything we do that's of any value is because of these gifts from God. Please turn to 2 Corinthians chapter 3. Just a couple of books over. 2 Corinthians chapter 3, starting verse 5, I guess it is. He says, "Not that we are sufficient of ourselves to think of anything as being from ourselves, but our sufficiency is from God." So, no. I don't have anything particularly good that's natural to me. I'm not smart. I'm not strong. I'm not talented. I'm not anything. But that I have received whatever I have from God. My sufficiency, our sufficiency, is from God. Okay? We've taken something from Him, so now what happens? Well, it depends on what I do about it. If I take something from Him, I can say, "Oh, how nice, God. Thank you." And just hang on to it. I can do that, right? If that's what I do, the process stops. And the blessings He's given start going bad. That's not what I'm supposed to do, of course. Because taking is not such a great thing. The good part comes next. The good part is giving. Turn to Acts chapter 20. Acts chapter 20. This is one of those few little sayings of Jesus that isn't in the Gospels. Acts 20, verse 35. You happen to have a red letter edition, you'll see about, what is it, 8 or 9 words or something there, all of a sudden showing up in the middle of Acts in red ink, right? Jesus said, it's more blessed to give than to receive. The good stuff comes when we give. That's what helps me. That's what is the blessing. The blessing is not when God gives me something. Hey, it's a blessing. But the blessing that helps me is when I give it away. That's the blessing. It's more blessed to give than to receive. And it doesn't stop when I give it away, because God is one step ahead of the game. Turn to Luke chapter 6. One step ahead of me, anyhow. Luke chapter 6, verse 38. God makes a simple, straightforward, interesting promise. Just picking part of the verse here, first part. He says, give, and it shall be given unto you. So God gives me faith. He gives me a gift of, a talent or something, whatever it might be. And he says, Dave, do something useful with that. Help someone. And when you do, when you give it away, I'll give you something more. The process is supposed to continue forever, just like it had always gone on with Lucifer, up to the point where he said, yeah, I don't think I got enough. I'm just going to hang on to this batch. When Lucifer started trying to take care of himself, the process stopped and sin began. Probably the biggest conceptual problem that we get into with this, after all, we're all Christians, right? That's why we're in church. We're not so stupid as to say, I'm going to take all of God's blessings and hoard them for myself. Nobody's going to say that because that's just dumb. From a Christian perspective, anyhow, right? Not from any other perspective, it might make perfectly good sense. Just hang on to what I got. It's the best deal going, And from some other perspective, it might make sense. But from a Christian perspective, nobody's going to say that. What we do instead is we take the idea of take to give and we flip it on its head. And so now we've got the concept, I'm going to give to get a return. The good part is the return. Giving is what's necessary to get the return. And since I want the return, I'll give. But I'll only give maybe now and then, and when it looks like a good return on my investment. After all, we're God's stewards, right? And God wouldn't want us to waste his goods. So I should be looking for a good return on investment. Something not so prevalent in the financial world right now. Have you noticed what interest rates are doing of late? They're pretty well tanked. Sometimes we find ourselves in situations where it looks like the return on investment of the giving thing is not going to be that good. And to be honest, there is a certain amount of truth in that. Turn to Matthew chapter 7. There is a certain amount of truth to that. And like almost everything that God ever asks us to do, he tells us, here, do this, but keep it in balance between these two extremes. I don't know about you, but I have much more of a tendency to see two options and grab one or the other and go charging off after the one and ignoring the other. And God usually wants us to kind of just get a balance. Come on, Dave, get a grip. So here's a balancing statement. Matthew 7, verse 6. God says, do not give what is holy to the dogs, Nor cast your pearls before swine, lest they trample them under their feet and turn and tear you in pieces. So there's a time and a place when giving, at least certain kinds of giving, is probably not a good idea. Okay? So we don't have to go about this mindlessly. I'm just going to give away everything I've got and be a little hermit in a cave. Oh, great. Thanks. You know, I'm going to live on top of this pole for 38 years. Thank you, Simon, right? Everybody knows about Simon Stylites, right? No. He lived on top of a pole for 38 years because he figured that would make him more holy. I'm sure the world was blessed. Somehow. Anyhow. Okay, so there are things where God says, no, that's not a good time to give. Okay? But let's try and get the overall balance of this. So let's try a few other verses here. Matthew 10, verse 8. Just turn over a couple chapters. Jesus says, freely you have received. What? Freely give. Turn to Luke chapter 6. Luke chapter 6, verse 30. This is kind of a strange verse. This is going to, you know, make you scratch your head if you start thinking about it in anything resembling literal. Luke 6, verse 30. Jesus says, give to everyone who asks of you. And from him who takes away your goods, do not ask them back. Really? How exactly does that one relate to the whole thing about not casting your pearls before swine? It's an interesting question. I bet there's a balance there, and I bet it's, you know, I'm going to say that at times it will probably be tricky. At times it's going to have to be come down to a point of, you know, Lord, I'm not sure what I'm supposed to do this time. We're going to have to pray about some things. But you know what? That's fair. That's the cool thing about being a Christian. You can, you know, get help when you're in the middle of a test. It's not cheating. Go down a couple more verses. Luke 6:35. But love your enemies, do good, and lend, hoping for nothing in return. Now, I'll admit, I don't think I fully understand that. Does that mean I'm actively hoping that I'm not going to get it back? I think this guy, I bet if I lend it to him, I'll never get it back. That's what, you know, I'm not sure that's really what it means. I don't know exactly what it means. But do good and lend, hoping for nothing in return, and your reward will be great, and you will be sons of the Most High. For he, God, is kind to the unthankful and evil. I think I can understand the last part at least. The whole lending thing, I'll admit, I'm a little dicey on that yet. I'm not saying I got this all figured out. But I can understand the idea of being kind to the, who were they? The unthankful and the evil. And then Luke 6:38, we already looked at part of that. Give and it will be given to you, good measure, pressed down, shaken together, running over, will be put into your bosom, for with the same measure that you use, it will be measured back to you. Jump back to Proverbs. This is a great verse. I really like this verse. Proverbs chapter 19, verse 17. Proverbs 19, 17. It says, he who has pity on the poor lends to the Lord, and he, capital H, and God will pay back what he has given. Now that's interesting. I can lend to the Lord. That puts him in debt to me. You ever think of that? If I follow this advice, I can make it so God owes me. That's what it says. But the one thing all this takes in order to actually do this goes back to what we talked about before. And that is faith in God that he'll actually do what he says he's going to do. If I'm going to give it away, he says he'll give it back, or he'll give me something pressed down, good measure, right? If I lend to the poor, or if I, what was that? He has pity on the poor, lends to the Lord. So what is it? Yeah. If I have pity on the poor, God says he'll pay it back. Do I believe that? I won't be very generous in my lending to the poor if I don't believe it. So do I believe it? It all goes back to exactly the problem Lucifer had. If we have faith in God, it changes our perspective. If we don't really know for sure what God's up to and he's, I'm not sure that's going to work that way, it's going to change the way we deal with things. If I don't believe he'll take care of me, the natural reaction is to take care of myself. But that's the path to death. Like Ellen White said, self-preservation is the law of self-destruction. This whole thing is also the beginning of every imaginable evil. Okay? Just kind of follow this through. If I don't believe God's going to take care of me, that's a loss of faith. If I think I can do a better job of taking care of myself than God can, that's pride and stupidity, by the way. Okay. If I try to take care of myself in some way other than what God asks me to do, that's just plain old disobedience. If my influence convinces someone else that self-serving is a better law of life than service, that's lying. And if I put myself first instead of loving my neighbor as myself, God calls that stealing. And eventually, if the pressure gets strong enough, it ends up with murder. But if I trust God to take care of me, I don't have to spend my time worrying about that, and I can turn my attention to helping someone else with confidence. But here's a, just for whatever it's worth, that mindset, just my observation, is probably going to mean living life a little off the mainstream of society. It's not the way things normally run. It's not easy to do that because we've got a society that is really, really talented at scaring the socks off of people to make them think they have to fit in with the crowd. You don't want to do that, man. That's weird. The problem with that whole thing is that the crowd is a bunch of losers. A quick story. A silly little story, but it's one that has changed my thinking for years. When I was a junior in academy, the school I was at in the spring of the year had a track day, right? Where everybody, they run races and, long jump and high jump and, all this kind of stuff. And each, the freshmen and the sophomores and the juniors and the seniors are all keeping, score, and this is a big issue. But anyhow. The point of the story is that being a bunch of non-track and field enthusiasts, nobody did anything about this to prepare whatsoever until about 4 days before the track day. And all of a sudden, all the guys in the dormitories, we ought to practice, like as if 4 days worth of practice is going to make any difference. But whatever, it was a nice thought. So we talked to the coach. We said, "Hey, coach, we want to practice after supper tonight." Okay, he says, "That's fine." So we get out there for practice, and he's talking about these different dashes, right? You got the 50-yard dash, the 100-yard dash, and then a 220-yard dash. Okay? He's talking about all these different things and whatnot, and he made this really interesting point. He says, "Now on the 220-yard dash," he says, "you guys are not going to be able to sprint for 220 yards. You just don't have it." So on the 220, it's not the same as the 50 and the 100. The 50 and the 100 is just go, brother, for all you got. On the 220, you guys can't sprint that long. So it's more of a game of strategy. You got to know when to start kicking. If you kick too soon, bam, you flake out before the finish line. Oh, and that's so embarrassing. Okay, so we're processing all this, and he says, okay, let's give this thing a go here. And he lines up about 10 of us for a 220-yard dash. Even had his little starter's pistol thingy, right, which was kind of fun. And so we're all standing here, and I'm standing here looking at all these other guys, right? And I knew that some of these guys were better physical specimens than I was, but, you know, nonetheless, here I am. I'm on the starting line. Bam! And we take off, and we're all kind of jogging along, because nobody wants to sprint too soon and look stupid at the end. And I'm watching these guys, you know, and there's like Chuck was on my left, and Bill Guy was on, and I, you know, they were the guys I figured were going to win this race, and I'm watching them, you know. And they were watching somebody else, and that guy was probably stupid enough, he was watching me or something. I don't know, we jogged the whole thing, just nobody had the guts to start running. We just, we got around the finish line. It was like, you know, 10 yards away. And finally somebody's, you know, and they, you know, and the coach is just standing there and he looks and says, what was that? He says, I don't care who crossed the line, you guys all lost. If you run with the pack, you run with the losers. Society teaches us to run with the pack. If you want to stand out from the crowd, if you want to live a life that's more than ordinary, you need the confidence to be different, to live differently. You may be able to develop enough confidence based on a big ego. There are people who seem like they do that. We won't name any of them. There are several in the the world of fame at this point. But it never works. It always fails if you base it on ego. The confidence we need is knowing that God knows what's best for us each and that he will provide what we need when we obey the law of life. Unless we get the idea that this is all about money, something that our ridiculously monetarized society constantly reinforces. You know, I mean, it's like we're not smart enough to handle comparing apples and oranges, so we have to turn everything into dollars, and then we can compare it. You know, so society constantly makes us think about that. But think for a second about Jesus' parable of the sheep and the goats. Sheep are on the right hand, goats are on the left, right? The sheep are saved, the goats are lost. The sheep are rewarded and the goats are condemned based on what they did in terms of these things. Food. Did you feed anybody? Water. Did you give anybody a drink? Hospitality. Did you invite anybody to your house? Clothes. Ever give anybody some clothes? Care for the sick, and their willingness to ignore social stigma and visit the guy in the prison. Now, you can take all those things pretty much and turn them into money if you want to. And then you could sit there and compare, you know, oh, this is $1.95 and this is $2.07. Oh, so this is the better deal. You know, you could do that if you want to, but that's not the way Jesus presented it. We can think of those things in money, but Jesus didn't. What that means, at least to me, is that we can all live by the law of life. We can. Young or old, rich or poor, educated, uneducated, black, white, city, country, whatever it is, big, tall, strong, weak, it doesn't matter. We can all live by the law of life. to Jesus in the sheep and the goat, that parable, everything is really, really simple. And this is a depiction of the judgment, by the way. He doesn't ask, what did you believe on transubstantiation? He doesn't even ask if we can pronounce the word. All he asks is, how did you treat the least of these, my brethren? And that's where the law of life comes down to. And observing that law is the difference between life and death. Let's sing our closing song.
Let's all stand as we sing our closing song, number 574.